Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go down in order in the agenda today and start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 123. We'll have Kyle give us a quick summary, then move to Senator Riley.
Right. This is the second session.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 123 is a measure that would authorize the formation of children's special districts, and it provides the district with the authority to assess, levy, and collect taxes to pay the cost of children's services within the boundaries of the district. So the measure wouldn't create any special districts. It would rather, it's allowing for the creation of them. So it would include the children's special districts in the list of existing special districts that can be created. The measure defines children's services as services provided outside of school hours to children who are school-aged or younger, and it includes but is not limited to services related to education, civics, culture, arts and music, physical recreation, health and well-being, technology, and development of skills. To form the district, it does require a petition for formation to be signed by the greater of 15% or more of the electors in the territory or 100 electors. And then the measure does align with the formation and changes of the existing statute related to special districts. And just as this may sound somewhat familiar to the committee, as some of the same discussion points were in Senate Bill 1545 in the -1 amendment, at least in 2016. There are a few changes built in on top of that, but.
Yeah.
So frame of reference there.
Okay. Senator Riley, this is your bill. This is our second swing at this.
Right.
Can you give us your overview?
Sure. Basically, this is about a democracy. This allows people to vote on whether they want a special district for children. It doesn't have to be applied all over the state. It allows people, if they want to form this, and basically it's, as was stated, it's about out of school time. We have a lot of gaps when kids are on their own and need something to do, and there isn't enough that is available right now. There are places that have programs. Portland has a great programs, but unfortunately the rest of the state isn't there yet. But this would simply, as Kyle said, allow people to vote to create a special district after gathering enough signatures. And then if the special district is formed, it allows them to vote again to see if they want to fund these programs. So again, this is just about allowing people to vote. And I think it's time for it to come, and we need these programs for our young people. So.
Okay. We do have some people signed up to testify, so let's first of all call up some folks here that you may know. Don Domes and Katie Riley from Washington County.
Okay, you want to go?
I'll let you go first.
Thank you very much, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I have already submitted written testimony. I'm not going to read that.
Identify yourself for the record.
Oh, my name is Catherine Riley, and I live in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm also chair of the Washington County Kids organization, and we are supporting this bill. As I said, the highlights of my testimony are that there is a great need for out-of-school time programs, early childhood, after school, and summer, when kids do not have enough positive things to do. There are a number of programs in our state that do offer good programs, but there are large gaps, and the programs that exist oftentimes charge too much for many people to participate, And often they have waiting lists. So this is really a huge problem. So what this bill is all about is allowing people within their own areas to decide what kind of boundaries they might want to have and to sign on to actually have this on the ballot. And then people would have to vote for it. So it's not a matter of costing the state anything at this time. It's a matter of self-determination within local areas and doing that to support the success of kids academically and in their careers, because these programs have been proven to make that support possible and to have kids be successful. I think that's probably about what I want to summarize to say, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll go ahead. So my name is Don Domes. I'm a licensed tax and small business consultant from the Hillsborough area. I'm also a retired CTE technology teacher and a grandparent. And I want to encourage your support of Senate Bill 123. Students in Oregon are only in school 14 to 18% of the time. They're not growing up in an Oregon that existed 60 years ago, where kids were picking strawberries, cherries, beans, etc. most of the summer. Few of them live on farms, or for that matter, even have a garage with tools and someone to help them learn how to use them. Too many of our students are in a holding pattern until they get old enough to work. The loss of half of our CTE programs between 1995 and 2010 reduced the opportunity to take hands-on classes in schools. I do want to commend the legislature and those of you here for the efforts to restore over the last 6 years some of those CTE programs and those opportunities, and I want to thank you for that support. But our persistent low on-time graduation rate has prompted things like Measure 98, but that's targeted grade 9 through 12. What about the almost 400,000 students that are in the K through 8 category? In many school districts, those students are out between 2 and 3 in the afternoon. That leaves parents with a need for quality supervision until later in the afternoon, and that's also an absolutely golden opportunity to enrich the school day. There are many programs in the after-school and summer camp space. I've been significantly involved in many of those programs. 4-H as a child, programs like Girls Get It Summer Camps and after-school technologies and robotics programs as a coach and as a technology instructor. I have firsthand experience on the growth that occurs for students in those programs. The after-school time and summer time opportunities are low-hanging fruit that engage kids in very cost-effective ways. But we have to have leadership and organized programs for students to be able to access those. In the November election, we experienced a clear mandate from voters for CTE and outdoor school. While there are pay-for-participation opportunities, our voters want those opportunities for all students. We need more OST, which stands for outside school time programs, especially in some of the STEM and STEAM areas, to complement a lot of the typical sports programs that are available. But a lot of those STEM, STEAM type programs are in really short supply. In my school district, a after-school Lego robotics offering is often desired by four times the amount of kids that we can actually get into the program. I provided an analysis to the STEM Investment Council in March of 2015 about what it would take to get just 25% of the 4th through 8th grade students into a 50-hour outside school time, basically after-school program. We figured that would be close to 54,000 students. In order to do that, we would need over 2,000 people that would run those programs, assuming we could hire certified teachers who could handle 25 kids at a time. The bill to do all of that was about almost $11 million, but when you back that into the number of students, and it's in my written testimony, the math on this, it's only $200 a student, which is an incredibly wonderful ROI on that investment. It's not free, but it's highly cost effective. Using outside school time provides a cooperative opportunity to access our local communities, our schools, put those groups together in a collaborative way, but we've got to have a funding mechanism so that we can get stability. Kids will get involved, but they want to know the program is going to be there. Parents will get involved, but they want to know the program is going to be there. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday at Glencoe High School, the state first Lego League robotics tournaments are going on. If any of you or anyone in the audience wants to come between 10 and 2 at Glencoe High School, I'll be there giving VIP guest tours and love to show you the impact that the robotics program is having on kids. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you, and I commend both of you. You've dedicated a big part of your life to helping young people. I appreciate that. Can you walk us through the mechanics of how this would work, and maybe Senator Riley as well? This passes into law. So then, say Washington County, for example, or what would be your likely next step after that?
I think we would work with partners in the community to decide on exactly what boundaries there might be in an area. In our particular area, we might want to have it be countywide, but we would also work with, say, the recreation district of THPRD, Twelton Hills Park and Rec, to make sure there's no conflict in terms of association there. And then we would probably draft a measure, an initiative that we would then be able to file and then start collecting signatures. And usually, I believe, on initiative, you've got 2 years to collect the required number of signatures to get on the ballot. So that would be the first step. We would probably be identifying also the people who would run to be the commissioners for that special district, because you would have to have that too. And we would be costing out, you know, what would be involved so that we could inform the people in the district that we're approaching for signature exactly what would be involved in terms of the administration of that. Assuming that passes, then, you know, then their board might decide that this, that there would need to be a levy to finance these programs. So that would be another step. So there are a lot of hurdles to go through. This is not automatic. All that this bill would do would allow people to move forward and to try to adopt this. There was a poll that we conducted in 2014 of people in the county, and there was about 57-58% who said they would vote for having a levy. So that's further on down the road. So that was a pretty good response. And obviously there would be a lot more work involved before we got to that point. But this would allow that formation. Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, this really empowers local control. And as Senator Riley expressed, it allows the democratic process to go on. That we've had this huge change in our society from being a rural and agrarian society in small towns to these, if you have been in the metro area and you've seen these buildings that are going up for people to live in, I mean, where's the place for a kid to have access to anything to touch? Mm-hmm. And we only have so many parks. I think societally we need to look at this, and especially from a workforce standpoint, if these kids on the farm, we used to say if the kid didn't learn how to work by the time they were 14, they may never learn how to work. And so I don't know if we can get them back on the farms, but at least I know what I'm seeing in these robotics programs with kids and how that ends up translating out, helping them pick careers and other opportunities later on.
Well, you did say something that resonated with me, and the kids aren't picking strawberries anymore. And
that's right.
Part of my childhood. Didn't love it, but...
But you learned. I can tell you learned so much from that. And and you were around adults. You were around adults.
Red stains.
Yeah.
I learned the difference between red and green.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, being in the minority, I do think you turned out all right, though. Okay.
Oh, okay. All right, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gil Riddell and Cindy Robert.
Shall I go?
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gail Riddell, Policy Director, Association of Oregon Counties. each service that would be provided by this new kind of district is a good thing. My points are simply that they can be provided by existing local districts with local control. Schools with expanded curricula, cities, and for some, park and rec districts and health districts. A new district threatens more Measure 5 compression, and since it is a mixed levy, it will it could hit already heavily compressed school districts. The county assessors tell me that they can handle mixed levies without too much trouble, but there still may be litigation from time to time about which category a particular levy was put into. And that's the extent of my comments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Oregon Recreation and Park Association. We have 104 member organizations, 62 are park and rec agencies, 8 are nonprofits, and 34 are commercial members. Of those members, 15 are special districts, and 29 are municipal agencies, and they're all funded with property tax. I don't think I need to tell this committee about the problems that we have with compression, but that's what concerns us most on this really noble bill. Unless we figure out a way to make that pie bigger, we're concerned about taking more slices out of that pie. It's just not feasible from our standpoint. Furthermore, the 15 actual special districts that I have involved in the organization and the cities who are already receiving property tax could be accused of double taxation in those areas for two different pieces of property tax going towards children programs. So while the reasoning behind the bill is important and it's critical to the fabric of our communities, I want to share with you what your local park and rec programs are already doing that actually mimic what this legislation is trying to do. The Tualatin Hills Park and Rec is a taxing district. They offer sports programs, but they also have 3,590 weekly participants in their programs that have to do with classes and traditional after-school programs. Tualatin Hills offers preschool programs, child care, and other school programs including swimming, sports, art and craft, drama, homework help, and outdoor play. The middle school programs also include group community service projects that they're very proud of. In addition to nature camps, Tualatin Hills makes a very big effort with the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts to also offer environmental education, things like bug safari, secret life of seeds, for the birds and forest recycles. They are very dedicated to customizing programs for school districts in the area and trying to bring in environmental sciences into engineering, math, English, language arts, and special education classes. In your district, Senator Boquist, the Dallas City Park and Recs Department runs the Kids Incorporated program, and that's dedicated to making affordable community sports available to kids, and they have a program called Mighty Mites that provides the youngest kids in the area with after-school programs and young athletic competitions. The city also runs an aquatic center for all ages and a civic center where education opportunities occur. They also sponsor, the Parks and Rec Department sponsors the children's room at the library that includes summer reading programs, after-school homework help, and a kids' book club. In your district, Senator Taylor, North Clackamas Park and Rec District is a special district, and so they are already taxing the citizens to provide some of the programs. The district offers sports for children as well as affordable youth programs, after-school activities, and camps on art, dance, drama, exercise, fitness, self-defense, and outdoor adventure. A lot of these programs are done after school. A lot of them provide transportation. I noted in Senator Barrett Sugar's district in particular, a lot of transportation, two different programs after school focused in that area on helping those kids who have no place else to go. I urge you just to consider the impact of a new taxing district on the programs already being made available.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Taylor?
Thank you, Senator House. I just have more of a comment. I appreciate the bill, and I appreciate what these folks here are saying. In this case, I think that both are right, because I can tell you from firsthand experience, being heavily involved in school, being a PTA president, being, you know, having a 12 and a 15-year-old and having my children in public school, there are programs, and yes, there are kids who are not getting services, and they're hanging out with nothing to do. And that is not healthy in some cases. And so even at Selwood Middle School, where my daughter goes, there's kids where they're just, it's not a lot going on for some of the kids. But at the same time, there's the Boys and Girls Club who comes and, you know, has some vans and takes some kids to programs. So there's both going on, but there is a gap that needs to be filled. I don't know if we can do that here in the Revenue Committee, Chair Hass, but there is a, I do think that Senator Riley has tapped into something that is a real issue, and it isn't, you know, I can see why you're concerned and how it feeds into kids who have trouble as they get older and go to high school and et cetera. And I know that the local jurisdictions are doing a lot, and I see that firsthand as a parent and being heavily involved in my area. So in this case, both are right. I'm not sure what the solution is, but both I definitely think are equally concerned and are both correct. So I just wanted to say that. So.
Yeah. Well said.
Thank you.
Senator Riley.
I just want to say I absolutely agree with the senator, and both are right, and you know, the park and recs districts are doing great work. They just don't fill every need, and we have lots of kids, especially summertime, who are just at ends. They don't know what to do. They'd like to go and do some of the programs at Park and Rec, but some of them cost money, and these kids don't have any money. There are scholarships, but parents sometimes don't want to take those scholarships. So we'd like to have, you know, those kids who are most at risk have these opportunities, and I think this is the way that we can get that done. And the money doesn't all have to come from taxpayers. Special districts, as you know, can apply for grants. There are all sorts of different ways that money can become available. But we do need to let the people decide whether they want this or not.
Mr. Chair, I might mention, if I may, that I wish the cities were here, because I know, living in Salem, there are a lot of programs during the summertime organized by the cities. By the city of Salem, and I suspect that's not atypical.
Okay, thank you both. Mark Landauer, Wendy Johnson.
Cities are here,
yes.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Much has been said. This is a noble cause that Senator Riley has taken up, and I certainly recognize that there are gaps in the current system. One type of special district that hasn't been mentioned thus far anyway that do provide various programs for kids would be library districts as well. A lot of various programs that are offered through the district. We are opposed to the bill for many of the reasons that were articulated previously. I have an appointment at 9 o'clock with another representative, so at this point I'll just conclude my remarks. You have my written statement, and thank you, and happy to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you. Forgive me, I'm going to excuse myself. Thank you.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Again, we support the concept of wanting to help kids, but we just don't think this is the right mechanism. And it's not. It's really because of the property tax part of it. If the authority to create these districts didn't have the authority to also levy property taxes, we wouldn't have a problem with it. So that's in Section 5, Sub 4 of the bill. If that would go away, we could support it. But let me explain more of why. Measure 5, of course, has the caps that you're very well aware of, the $5 cap for school districts and the $10 cap for local governments. That's in the Constitution, and until those caps are raised, we're stuck with them. And that means with compression, if you create a new district, that new district has to either go into the $5 camp or the $10 camp. And we can't tell from this bill which one it would go under, because there's a list of things that this special district, children's district, could do. We know from a court case, the Orhausen case, that we have to decide which one it goes in. And in that case, the city of Eugene was trying to levy, it was 86 cents per thousand, and 7% of the month they came in was supposed to be used for services for youth, so something like this. And then 93% of it was going to go to the school districts, both the Bethel and the Eugene school districts. And the court said you have to separate those out and get those numbers right. So when they analyzed the case, they said education services are, you know, supporting schools, that type of thing. But also it doesn't include civics or recreation programs. So those would go in the local government group. So if this new district would be for rec or for civics, which is in your list of things, it would, the ox that would be gored would be cities and counties and special districts, because that's in the local government side of the $10. If it was the other things that you've listed, education and music and such, then it would be the school district's ox that would be gored on their $5. So just to give you a couple examples, the city of Portland is already losing $13 million in compression from their permanent rate. That's not even the local option. They're losing another $8 million in local option. So if it would be in the government side of the equation, the city of Portland would be losing if they created a new district. And if it was in the school district camp, just to give you a couple examples, Hillsborough is already losing $1.5 million from their permanent rate. And Tigard is losing $525,000 from their permanent rate and another $3.2 million from the local option. So it just depends on who's going to lose here, what type of district. So, again, if you fix the property tax system, we can have local control, and we would certainly support this type of district. But because these services can already be provided by the existing local governments or school districts, depending on the type of service, we have to oppose the bill and just would respectfully request that you, if you want to allow it, just to take out that property tax authority. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? All right, thank you. And Douglas Schmidt. Doug, we probably should just keep a seat up here for you.
Stop doing this.
Some of us would like to.
Yeah.
But we're not going to.
Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm also testifying on behalf of the Assessors Association. A lot of what has been said is what I was going to bring up. Basically, this district could create a split district, a split rate district. We believe that we can administer that split rate district. There are some counties that are doing that to a degree right now. So I just wanted to testify on that half as far as administration. We believe that we can administer this bill. Thank you. Any questions? Do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's all who signed up to testify here in person, but you can see on OLIS quite a few people have weighed in on this. I'd say they're falling into the supportive category on that.
About a dozen of them up there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 123, and we'll hear back from you. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 807. Kyle.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 807 would allow a health district that does not impose, assess, levy, or otherwise collect taxes on property within the territory of the district to invest in securities. It does take effect 91 days following adjournment, signing die. And in the background of the SMS, I did include the statute authority and the purpose contained in statute for the reason for these health districts, just to give some background there. But districts may be formed for the purposes of providing clinically related diagnostic treatment and rehabilitative services, providing outreach programs and healthcare education, serving as a resource for healthcare providers in the district, and also promoting the physical and mental health and well-being of the districts. So that's the purpose as stated in statute.
Okay.
Why are we doing it now?
Where's the bill emanating from?
Are you
This is Senator Roblin and McKellen's bill, and I don't see them here. So we're going to...
Are they going to come?
I don't believe we heard back from them.
I'm just curious why.
Yeah, indicating whether they would come or not.
See, at least with mine, we're studying something we're already studying. I'm just not... Do one of these districts exist, and why are we going to do this?
Just doing a rough look, Senator.
You're making this up, right?
No, I mean, I did look before the hearing, and it's an incomplete list. The information that's available that's reporting the number of districts that do actually impose a tax from the list that's available on the Department of Revenue's website. And again, this is there may be districts that are not reporting because they're not levying any tax. But I came up with three districts that do not levy tax that are categorized as health districts. And there was the Clatsop County Ambulance District, Powers Health, and Mountain View Health.
Are any
the
of these
remaining of these were imposing.
Are there any of these in Senator Roblin or Representative McEwen's district? I would think it's in the south half, the southern coast is where we're addressing some problem or issue. You don't know.
I didn't get to that level of analysis for it now.
Okay.
Well, we'll just close the public hearing and possibly revisit this. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 756.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 756 directs the Legislative Revenue Officer to study land value taxation. And this is an issue that the committee has discussed a number of times in the past. And the notion of differential property tax rates for land versus capital or improvements is a longstanding one in this country and has been an issue that has been put into place. I'm sure you have some testimony on this and some local areas around the country historically. We do think in terms of standard economic theory that the most efficient tax is the one that's on the raw value of land, because that is an immobile factor of production. It's not going to move. You're not going to affect the production of land. So, however, the capital portion of it is a reproducible capital is mobile and does move across districts. So it is, if you impose a tax on capital, it's subject to, it'll affect the net return to capital and therefore influence the location of capital. That's economic theory. So it's more responsive. So a differential rate would have the effect of taxing your mobile factor less and your fixed factor more, which is a more efficient method of taxation. Mm-hmm. The bill itself, if you look under, Kyle has got that on the screen, section 1, sub 2, directs Legislative Revenue Office to conduct a study of land value taxation and goes through some specific areas involving the tax burden effects, or this would be an incidence issue that we have done a lot of work on in recent years. It would compare looking at assessments at true market value. It would have us work through a revenue neutral framework. It would have us do some comparative economic incentives, in other words, looking at the potential effect on capital in particular, and an examination of methods of split rate land value tax, which is just as we're talking about, would have a differential rate between the two factors of production, capital. So it's something that we would be able to do. It would be a major project for us. We'd certainly be, but I think we have the tools to look at it. And if you were to direct us through this bill, then it's something we'd obviously prioritize and put it within our interim work plan.
And would you be able to do this study if you were also working on the implementation of a tax reform bill like the one we're looking at? The workload issue, I guess.
Well, I think so, Mr. Chair. I see this large as kind of a part of the issue around property tax reform that you talked about. I mean, the biggest impediment we've seen to looking at this in practice, or we've talked about setting up a pilot area and so forth, has been the common theme in this committee, the limitations caused, particularly by Measure 50. Because the only way to make it work would be to have tax districts that would have a sub-permanent rate. You can always go lower than the permanent rate, but you can't go higher. So if you have a split rate system, you'd have to have a permanent rate on capital that's less than what your constitutional rate is. And it's hard to find districts that are in that position to be able to do that. But I think it is something we could work on within the context of general property tax reform. Certainly, if there is a major business tax reform, as you've talked about in this committee, that would take a lot of our time as well. But I think it wouldn't preclude this.
Okay.
Cool. Senator Boquist, did you want to weigh in on this at all?
Sure, and you have testimony?
There. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Just outline, this is not a new topic. We've actually discussed this before and never actually gone through and done it. It's actually a constituent bill that came forth. Senator Beyer actually has another bill that's very similar, actually almost identical to this. I would just point out that, you know, one of the times when you deal with lawyers, in which we don't, and we deal with economists, is this should have been written in a single chamber resolution telling ourselves we're going to go do it. And of course, both of them came as bills instead of resolutions. But once again, it's another component of the whole property taxation issue that we've thought in the past we should address but haven't addressed it, and as you just point out, it's always been a workload issue. Something else has pushed it off the table. And it's another key component of comprehensive tax reform, even if it's an abbreviated approach. And then I'll let the witnesses speak to it themselves.
Okay, well, let's call up Chris Nelson and Paul Justice.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I'm Chris Nelson with Common Ground, Oregon, Washington. As this committee well knows, it passed a longer version of this bill in 2015. And since then, we've streamlined the provisions to both ensure that there's no fiscal impact, as it's defined, and to expedite the study results. The intent here is to make the findings on the economic incentive effects of a land-weighted property tax available as soon as possible so that legislators can consider the policy options to really craft a permanent fix to our broken property tax limitations. As legislators well know, Measures 5 and 50 have created widespread economic distortions and inconsistent property tax obligations. That's pretty well understood. And our study of Salem's early experience with the tax limitations and use of maximum assessed value showed that tax burdens shifted off of rapidly appreciating properties and onto slower or even decreasing value-creating properties. And statewide, the effect really has been to shift the tax burden onto residential properties overall. And because Measures 5 tax limitations have caused local levies to go uncollected, just fixing the compression problem alone really leaves out the underlying unfairness of Measure 50. And moreover, leaving the equal rates unaddressed misses the disincentive to invest in capital improvements. So the statewide lack of housing supply is evidence of this penalty. How can we permanently fix these problems while maintaining a check on unlimited growth in property taxes? Well, with this bill, we can consider the broader context of the use of differential rates in some 20 Pennsylvania cities over the last 80 years, and even in Hawaii. That use of a lower rate on improvements and compensating on a revenue neutral basis with higher rate on land gives several advantages. First, similar to enterprise zones we use already in Oregon, by cutting the rate on improvements, we provide an incentive, we remove the disincentive to make capital investments. And this consistently leads to increased building permit volumes, redevelopment in commercial and multifamily zones, an increasing housing supply, higher lending activity, increased employment, and even an expanding tax base. And adjusting the rate on land assessments, as Paul Warner here referred to, essentially eliminates the deadweight loss on a tax. And as he explained already, this drag on the economy actually is evident in all other taxes, including sales and income taxes. And thirdly, when an improvement assessments become less important, then property tax appeals actually decrease. Who can argue with that? And it actually leads to efficiency in tax assessors' offices, as that's been shown in Pennsylvania communities widespread. So according to our accepted economic principles, value created in property legitimately belongs to the source of that value creation. Improvement value stems from private investment, of course, on specific parcels. So owners really should have the legitimate right to retain most of that building value, which they have created. Whereas land value is very different. Land value accrues from public investments and actions like upzoning, as well as natural amenities, you know, local advantage, and even population growth. So the community is really justified in capturing its legitimately created value in land. Well, you've had a chance to review the provisions of the study. I won't go into those, but we do have very important questions here to answer. And the longer we delay tackling these questions, the greater the opportunity cost to struggling communities that could unleash productivity gains, clearly available if we had a two-rate incentive tax system. So we ask you to support this bill as a means of bringing about proven prosperity for business, communities, and local government. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me say a few words, Senator Haas and the committee. My name is Paul Justice. I live here in Salem. I'm new to Oregon, to tell you the truth, but I have worked for many years as a regional planner and came across land value taxation about 10, 15 years ago and have always thought it was a good idea. I think Chris summed up what we're after here, but I just would like to point out that land value taxation is very transparent. It's easier, actually, for assessors to do, and you can't pick it up and take it to the Cayman Islands and hide it, so it works out better that way. And every day here I hear some issues about housing, especially in Portland, and this would, property taxes on the buildings disincentivizes that, and we've seen very good results in cities like in Pennsylvania that have, when they compare the same cities with other cities right next to them, they've had very good results. Every time they've applied the land value taxation, construction goes up, and these other cities actually, it went down. So there is some legitimacy to the whole idea, but it's good to have new studies to look at, and that's what I think we want to do here in Oregon before we act. And the Common Ground group that I am a member of now certainly supports this study. Thank you.
Thank you. I know we have looked at this and tried to get studies off the ground in the past, and I'm sympathetic to your points. I think on surface they make a lot of logic. If this is working in those Pennsylvania communities, why hasn't it sort of got more traction than that? Any guesses or speculation?
Chair Haas and members of the committee, a very good question. I'll start by actually referring to Oregon. There was a study conducted by the City Club of Portland in 2013, and their research group found that Multnomah County actually used a differential property tax rate in the 30s. And we know what happened to land values in the 30s. They didn't go up. So we have a little history here, despite the economic woes of the last century in its use. And Hawaii has actually used this for over 30 years successfully. In fact, it works so thoroughly in Honolulu County that they actually lowered the rates on land and had to adjust the rates upward on improvements to try and mitigate some of the rapid growth there. We don't really know specifically why this hasn't spread to other states, but we do know that recently states such as Connecticut and Maryland have begun pilot projects and passed legislation to experiment with differential rates. We do know that even back 15 years ago in Pennsylvania, by initiative, the citizens of Pennsylvania expanded the enabling of a differential rate to burgs, a jurisdiction we don't use here, but that demonstrated its popularity by popular vote there. So we can even point to perhaps the change in higher education as it relates to economic theory and approach, this concept that Paul Warner brought up recently, really have been left out of academic economic theory in the last 50 years. So there are a variety of factors at play there. Hope you answered my question.
Other questions of these two gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much for your work on this.
Thank you.
Wendy Johnson.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, the League has been working here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League has been working with Chris and talking to him for the last couple years as well, as the League is very interested, as you know, in property tax reform. So the League is neutral on this bill. And I would even sort of lean towards support because it's studying an important issue. But I think the reason we're neutral is that we're hoping the time is over for discussion and studying it. We really need the property tax reform to happen. And so this would just continue that discussion. And Chair Haas, we appreciate your leadership on that and would support SJR 3 well and above this bill because we would like to get the system fixed. The split rate idea is important and it's an interesting idea, but as you pointed out, it's used so little. It's an idea to talk about perhaps down the road, but the state is used to the rate system we have, and it would be another big change in an already complicated system. So we would like to start there. We don't think it really is a workload issue. We'd be happy to support the study, but it's the political issue is the real issue, and so we're just concerned about the optics on changing another piece of an already complicated system. But that said, looking at a revenue neutral framework as this would provide and looking at incentives for urban and rural jurisdictions as sub C provides are important issues. And just the split rate and homestead exemption that are provided in here are all great components to study. And so we would like to support that if the bill would go forward. But we don't want to lose the momentum on talking about how to fix the system now. We recognize it's a heavy lift to fix the property tax system this session, especially as you tackle business tax reform, but we hope we're closer by the end of this session, and if we don't get it out this session, we would in the February. And this bill has the study happening September of 18, and that's just another, it's just too long to be waiting to get the system fixed, and we're in a crisis now with our schools and our local government. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 756. We have no other bills to introduce, no other work before us.
That's it on the bills.
That's it on the
last day.
Yeah.
You have enough to make the 6 o'clock news for a month.
That's right. Okay. There's no shortage of bills. Yes.
Right.
All right. Tomorrow.
No shortage of rumors either.
8:30. Until then, we are adjourned. 8:30. Until then, we are adjourned.